This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, how data and technology are transforming how employers measure your success. But first, some news headlines. Viagra has been on the market and available to men for nearly two decades. And this week, the Food and Drug Administration approved Addy, the first drug for women targeted at enhancing sexual drive. Is the little pink pill a win for women's sexual health, or is it just Big Pharma pushing another blockbuster product? Here to talk about that and other selected short subjects in science is Virginia Hughes, senior editor at BuzzFeed News. She's here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science. Welcome back, Jane. Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
Tell us about this new miracle pill from women.
Yeah, it's generating quite a bit of controversy this week and also excitement. The company that makes it was just sold yesterday, I think, or the day before, for $1 billion after the after the approval.
If this is a blockbuster, that'll be cheap, won't it?
I mean, clearly they're expecting a lot of sales of this. So it's also controversial because it's been in this FDA approval process for 5 years, and it was rejected twice before. First for efficacy, so it just didn't work very well, and the second time for side effects. So it turns out in some women, it causes low blood pressure and fainting, and these side effects can be worse if you're drinking alcohol, which, considering what the drug is for, might not be that unusual.
Especially the fainting part.
Yeah, so it's definitely a very controversial pill. Mm. I think what's really fascinating about it is that its manufacturer, this small company called Sprout Pharmaceuticals, partnered and partially funded an advocacy group called Even the Score. And for the last year, year and a half, Even the Score has been putting out all kinds of campaigns to align the pill with a pro-feminism movement. So Even the Score, the name Even the Score, comes from this idea that there are tons of drugs that have been approved for male sexual dysfunction, and there's been zero for women. And so we want to even the score by getting this drug approved. And the leadership of the company has been, you know, parroting this message too. So they've, you know, aligned with women's groups. And
well, we'll just have to see, right? We have to crowdsource the drug and see if it works or not.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah. Next up, a study came out. This was kind of sort of sad. It looked at the use of e-cigarettes in kids.
Yeah. So this study looked at ninth graders who showed that ninth graders who use e-cigarettes were much more likely to smoke cigarettes by 10th grade than their peers who hadn't. So, you know, it's an observational study, and it's pretty preliminary. It's not saying that this definitely proves that e-cigarettes, you know, are a gateway drug to regular smoking. Mm-hmm. But it is suggestive of that, and the question of whether e-cigarettes are good or bad for health has been this huge debate in the public health community, because some people say if you're a smoker and you switch to e-cigarettes, that's such a win because they don't have tobacco in them, so they don't have the carcinogens of tobacco going into your lungs. But if this study pans out, it could mean that they're actually, you know, encouraging.
Well, you get to be a drug addict. I mean, nicotine is one of the most highly, you know, addictive drugs that we know.
Yeah,
of,
and, and the, right now the e-cigarette industry is not at all regulated, so kids can go into these vape shops and buy whatever products they want. You know, but that said, caffeine is an addictive drug too, and we don't, you know, kids can drink that if they want to. So the FDA, though, is planning on releasing its first regulations on e-cigarettes by the end of the year, and they will most likely be regulated as tobacco is, so probably restricted so that minors can't buy them and will have to go through an approval process.
Mm-hmm. Google released a new tool called Project Sunroof.
Yeah, so this is neat. It's so for folks who are considering or may have once considered putting solar panels on their house, it's a big investment, right? I think it's like $20,000 to put solar panels on your roof. So, and it's kind of a question of whether it makes economic sense. If it depends on like the sun exposure that your neighborhood gets, and also like whether other buildings would put shade on your roof, and it's kind of a complicated thing. But Google Maps has made this little app that will calculate this all for you, and it'll look at weather patterns in your neighborhood and even like the shade that will hit your roof and calculate for you the cost savings that would be likely for you and whether you should take the plunge.
Well, Google Earth already can see your roof.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is data they're already collecting, believe it or not. Big Google.
just making it more bureaucratic by saying fill out these, you know, this little form and say, we know what your roof looks like. And we'll get that planter moved over.
Or you could say they're helping you, you know, save the environment.
Mm-hmm. And it's available everywhere?
No, it's available in San Francisco, Boston, and Fresno, but they'll probably be rolling it out.
Yeah. And there was a really quirky story about, I saw this today online, a vomit machine.
That's right.
If you can't vomit yourself, we'll make a machine.
Yeah. So this was a group of scientists at North Carolina State University who wanted to see exactly how vomiting would help spread disease. So how viral particles inside of vomit might stick around in the air or not, or land with the vomit on a surface. So the machine, if you saw it, it's this weird clay model of a human head at one quarter the size of a real human head, and it has an open mouth, and it's hooked up to this pressure system that spews vanilla pudding that simulates, I guess, the exact viscosity of vomit.
Mm-hmm.
And so scientists can put virus into this pudding, and it spews into a plexiglass box, which can then calculate how many of the viral particles stay in the air.
Are there enough in the air?
There are. Yeah. There aren't. It's a very small fraction of the total that stays in the vomit, but you don't need very much to get infected. So it turns out that this norovirus can indeed spread by vomit.
Yeah. Well, something you could build at home if you'd like to, I guess. Thank you, Virginia. Virginia Hughes, science editor at BuzzFeed News. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. And we're ready to play Good Thing, Bad Thing because, you know, every story has a flip side. Scientists have identified nearly 2,000 exoplanets, from Saturn-sized gas giants that have two sunrises, sunsets every day, to Earth-like planets that might be just right for life. And they can really stretch the imagination, but except for the names of these exoplanets, hardly imaginative. Anyone recall B1620-26b? No, put your hands down. People have always wanted a chance to name the planets, but the International Astronomical Union has always reserved that privilege for itself. But now it's relaxing its grip just a bit by opening the naming process up to the crowd. The Name Exo Worlds contest is allowing the public to nominate and vote on the name of 15 stars and 32 exoplanets. So maybe the planet Vulcan, a fan favorite, might have a chance. So what could go wrong? Here to talk about good and bad of crowdsourcing planetary names is Lee Billings, space and physics editor at Scientific American here in New York. Hi, Lee.
Great to be here as always.
The good news.
So the good news, obviously, is that people are getting involved, and that's good because planets, as you said, have had really kind of ridiculous names for a long time. A few of my favorites I'm going to read to 2-mass J0441449 plus 2301513B. As one. Another one is MOA 2007 BLG 192 LB.
It's more like a credit card number.
Yeah, right? These are ridiculous names. And so planets deserve names. Planets are the pathway that the universe has to make names. Planets make the namers of names, living things, right? And so planets without names are kind of sad. So it's good that people are getting involved and they're beginning to debate what names mean for planets. And that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And the bad news?
Well, the bad news is that, first of all, some of these names that are being submitted and voted on are kind of glib, right? For instance, Paul Kallas, an astronomer who discovered or co-discovered a planet called Fomalhaut B, which is one of the first ones we've actually seen. We've seen it orbiting this nearby star Fomalhaut. He submitted that this planet should be called Phantasos. That's a Greek god of dreams, both in reference to his own heritage and also to the idea that a lot of people thought that this planet was illusory for a long time, essentially a figment, a dream of Kallas's imagination. Well, Phantasos is not a name you can vote for this planet.
It's not.
You can call it Planet Ninja or Planet Leisurely Fish, if you want to, but not Fantasso. So that's a thing.
I heard Edamame is a choice.
And that's another thing, is that the ballot boxes have kind of gotten stuffed a little bit because Japanese astronomy clubs have been over the moon, so to speak, for this contest. And so they've submitted name after name after name for system after system after system. And so essentially, there's going to be planets, if it goes through, there will be planets that are named after all varieties of soybeans from Japan, after Japanese desserts, Japanese professional wrestlers. There will be endless sakuras and kaguras and amaterasus and things. And so it's you could say it's a clash of countries potentially, where maybe the U.S. should stand up and care about these planets.
Maybe those Trekkies, is the voting open to any name or have they limited? Can the Trekkies stuff the ballot box with Vulcan now if they wanted to?
Unfortunately, it's a semi-private and public process for finding these names. So they consulted all these clubs and private institutions to get a pool of names that then the public can vote on. So unfortunately, the writing's already on the wall. It looks like we're going to have a lot of soybean-named exoplanets pretty soon. The real problem here is that, of course, we don't know anything about these worlds we're naming. So we could call something, for instance, Venus, thinking it's going to be a lovely planet like the goddess of love, and instead it's this hellish world right next door. We could be making that mistake all over the place, all over the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. So how can we get in on it? How does the voting take place?
Well, if you go online, I'm not quite sure how they've avoided how they're dealing with all the issues around ballot box stuffing and stuff for votes. But essentially, if you go online and just Google name Exo Worlds or go to the IAU website, you can vote there. And as long as you have an internet connection and a computer, you can vote.
Are you voting? Are you going to get in? Do you have a name?
I have voted. The only name I'm really voting on is Hubris. For a pulsar that has a planet.
Yeah, because that's what everybody who's voting has a little bit of.
Exactly.
Is it? All right. Well, good way to end. Thank you, Lee. Lee Billings is the space and physics editor at Scientific American here in New York. We're going to take a break. And after the break, what happens when tracking technology targets truckers, retail clerks, UPS drivers, keeps track of where everybody is going, what they're doing, and why hedge fund managers are measuring their biometrics. Tough day on Wall Street about that. We'll tell you why after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Our long-form story this week, if you, like we at Science Friday, read the New York Times and read that Times investigation this week about Amazon and how it uses data and tech tools to rank employees, measure their efficiency, gamify the workplace, you might have wondered, is this the future? Is this the new normal? Well, we did, and looking into it, we discovered that this idea of using data to track employee progress, rank performance, it's nothing new. It goes way back. But in the last 5 to 10 years, as data mining and mobile technology have gotten cheaper and more sophisticated, these tech metrics have invaded all kinds of industries, from McDonald's to truck driving, from fashion retail to the office cubicle. For example, some authors might soon be paid not by the book, but only by the pages that you actually read when you download it on Amazon. Or how about the employee who has sued her boss for firing her after she uninstalled a smartphone tracking app that tailed her not only on the job, but everywhere she went? Is this the future of work? Can all of this technology measure us fairly without being invasive while preserving our humanity? Or does it reduce us to a bunch of data points? Can it, as one of my guests writes, count the uncountable aspect of our work? What do you think? Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. Maybe you work in an office like this and you'd like to talk about it. Maybe you've been affected by this. Let me introduce my guests. Esther Kaplan is an editor at the Investigative Fund, a nonprofit reporting workshop in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. So glad to be here.
You're welcome. Karen Levy is a fellow at the Data and Society Research Institute here in New York, and she joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome.
Hi, happy to join.
Esther, let's start with you. How far back does this sort of stuff, electronic monitoring metrics in the workplace, really go?
Well, this is a subject I reported on for Harper's Magazine a few months back. And, of course, tracking worker productivity goes all the way back to Taylorism 100 years ago. But electronic monitoring is relatively new. It began with call centers in the 1990s, and maybe in the early 2000s we started seeing employers monitor the email and web use of their employees. And it's only been in the last maybe 8 or so years that we're starting to see telematics, which is the monitoring of objects like trucks, no longer requiring human inputting of data, but objects themselves reporting into a big database. And these huge data-driven scheduling systems come into play, as I said, 7 or 8 years ago. And it's only in the last 3 to 5 years, really, that we're seeing the kinds of things that we saw in that Amazon article in the Times, which is the monitoring arriving in, as you said, in the cubicle, white-collar knowledge workers, not just data entry clerks, but people who are doing very high-level tasks.
Because we have, we have stuff that didn't exist many years ago, the GPS system, the RFID devices, stuff that's stuck, it could even be in your skin and can't take it out.
And incredibly cheap data storage, right? So you now have the capacity to collect more or less an unlimited amount of data about your workers. And this is, of course, part of the challenge. Part of it, what interested me is what is it like as a worker to experience being monitored in this minute way. But for managers also, they've now got a giant tsunami of data coming at them every day. Do they even know what to do with it?
Karen, let's talk about some of the workers. I know you spent several years studying how tracking and metrics are changing the lives of truck drivers.
Yeah.
You wrote it for Pacific Standard, a terrific new series, The Future of Work and Workers. Tell us what you found there.
Yeah, so I spent my dissertation research, actually, I spent about 3 years talking to long-haul truck drivers and other people who worked in long-haul trucking, managers, insurance companies, all kinds of different people, to try and get a sense for how the life of the trucker has changed in response to these technologies. Truckers have historically been, like, really independent workers, right? Like, they, you know, they went out on the road by themselves. You know, they would communicate with each other via CB radio. But besides that, you know, nobody was really telling them what to do. They just had to get from A to B on pretty much their own terms. And the types of technologies that Esther's referring to have just completely upended what the trucking workplace looks like, right? Because, you know, truckers are certainly subject to the same you know, capitalist forces as any other industry. And it really has become a race to the bottom in terms of trying to optimize, you know, their fuel efficiency, how fast they can get things from one place to another. We've all come to really expect, you know, that we're going to get our goods really quickly.
So what changed in their lives? What did they have to do that they didn't do before?
So what's happened to them is that, you know, a lot of things get counted in trucking. So like I alluded to, right, because like fuel efficiency is really key. A lot of truckers have their fuel consumption tracked by their employers. The big thing that I was looking at is the number of miles that truckers drive. So truckers, by and large, get paid by the number of miles that they drive, and their employers track that. But what the systems don't track is things that drivers don't get paid for. So what has happened is that drivers have started to internalize a lot of risks and costs that they didn't have to before. So things like the risks of, you know, bad weather, of congested traffic, you know, all kinds of unpredictable delays on the road. And then other things that we really want them to do, right? So we really want them to inspect their trucks. They're required to do that for safety reasons. You know, a lot of truckers weren't doing that because they weren't paid for that time, and those things didn't get measured. So what happens is that workers, you know, get incentivized to either cut corners or they end up taking on a lot of these burdens for themselves.
Esther, you, a few months ago, you wrote in Harper's Magazine that you weren't getting your UPS deliveries, just the notices, you know, they stick them on the door.
Right.
And then they weren't even ringing the doorbell. And you did some digging into this and found out why.
Yeah, well, echoing those comments, yes, the pressures on delivery drivers, I think, parallel what we've seen in long-haul trucking as well. A UPS worker, it turns out, now is monitored both by that handheld delivery information acquisition device, the Dyad in their hand, as well as 200 sensors on each delivery truck. And they get as many as 40 pages of data produced about each shift that they do. And if they are seen to have been spent too much time at a stop, too much time at a delivery, have had the back of their truck open too much, they will get called in. Discipline around this data is now routine.
So they have to maximize how fast they can move without delivering the packages then?
Well, the dyad is going to tell UPS what time, exactly where they are geolocated when they scan the package, when they pull it out of the truck, and exactly where they're geolocated when they report that it's delivered or not delivered. So they have to at least get pretty near the address that they're supposed to deliver. But if they're really pressed for time and they're behind on their metrics, one possible shortcut would be slap the slip on the door and just sprint back to the truck. Because if someone's home, that could be an extra 3 minutes, right? You wait for them to come down the stairs, they sign, it's a whole long interaction. So if you're getting way behind schedule, that's one way to have your GPS signal show that you attempted the delivery without actually chewing up those minutes, getting it into the person's hand.
I have a truck driver on the phone, Kyle from Flagstaff. Hi, Kyle. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead. Tell us your story.
Well, I'm 26 years old. I've been driving for 2 years, and I grew up being basically around data and being tracked by computers, and I couldn't imagine doing this job without all of this data. It's really valuable, and one of the biggest things that I have in favor of this is the fact that because my speed is tracked, and as your guest is saying about the inspections are recorded, when it comes to law enforcement, I have a trail of data that backs me up that shows that I'm doing my job properly. So in that regard, it's a positive thing.
Do you find the pressures to have to make shortcuts and do things more quickly than you would like to?
Actually, it's the opposite. Because everything is tracked. I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but there's a certain amount of hours you can drive in a day, 11 hours in a 14-hour working period. And I'm on an electronic logbook that is constantly updated. And it lets me know when I have 2 hours, 1 hour. And if I go 5 minutes over, if I can't find a place to park, the safety department is right on the phone asking me, you know, hey, you need to stop and whatnot. So I feel like in the end, it kind of protects me from having to cut corners and do things illegally or the things that are unsafe.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for that perspective.
I mean, I would just say that I think there are truckers who appreciate this, and there are truckers that have difficulty with it, because when we're talking about long haul, because you can only do that 11-hour of driving within the window, as the caller said, some truckers who, before that regulation came into play, might have pulled over for a nap when they were exhausted, might not do that now because they know they'd be chewing into their 11 hours of time. I think with a lot of these, there's a downside with the UPS drivers. Once they found out that their seatbelt use was being monitored, some of them started just permanently buckling them on their seat and not using them at all because, again, it was chewing up time to unbuckle and rebuckle, and they were getting pulled in if they were over their time quotas.
Yeah.
I would just like to add that, you know, no technology is good or bad. No technology has the same effect on everybody, right? Like, a lot of it depends on the context in which it gets deployed. And so it's great that, you know, Kyle, the trucker who called in, has had a good experience with it. And in some ways, data can really protect you from, you know, some things that he was talking about, right? But I've also encountered lots of trucking companies who have encouraged their employees, you know, maybe to log in as a second user so that they reset their time, or, you know, to find ways to kind of circumvent the technology too. So it just depends, I think, on
how does
that
the
context.
Teamsters Union feel about this? The unionized truckers, are they involved?
Yeah, I mean, the Teamster, the trucking labor interests have been involved. They're not nearly as powerful as they used to be, right? Because, you know, trucking deregulated about 35 years ago, and since then the role of labor has been diminished. But they have had some pretty significant wins in the regulatory sphere lately, you know, trying to make sure that drivers, you know, don't get harassed by their employers based on these data, things like that.
I want to bring on another guest to talk about how wearable technology that measures your location, who you talk to, how you're feeling, is being used in the workplace and whether it really works like it's supposed to. Andre Spicer is professor of organizational behavior at the Cass Business School at City University in London. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello there.
Hi. You had an article in the Harvard Business Review about wearables where what are some of the more extreme examples of wearable tracking technologies in the workplace?
Sure. So this year we published a book called The Wellness Syndrome with my colleague Carl Cederstrom. And in this we were looking at how our obsession with wellness has started to kick back and sometimes make us less happy and healthy. And a big part of this was the rise of wearables in the workplace. So we found some workplaces, like IKEA, gave people this as a Christmas gift, voluntary gift. Some companies like BP in the US gave it to their employees, and then they got a discount on their health insurance. But some of the companies started to make this compulsory. So one London hedge fund required its traders to wear these wearable devices, which would track how long they sleep, what they eat, how much they drink, etc., and then would correlate that with their trading patterns to track what they called biorisk. There was another case which I've just come across. I think it's Bank of America have been experimenting with tracking hormone levels of their traders. So they track their cortisol and their testosterone levels. So the idea is that if their testosterone and cortisol goes up too much, then they're more likely to make risky trades. So it's beginning to get not just under your skin, but down to your very hormone levels and to your day-to-day practices in life.
There's also sort of technology called the Pavlok. What is that?
Yeah. So one of the most fascinating cases we came across is a technology called Pavlok. So basically, it's a nod towards Pavlov, you know, Pavlov's dog, behaviorism. There's been a resurgence of behaviorism in recent years. And Pavlok basically works by, you say, okay, I need to not check my emails at work, for instance, or I need to go to the gym or something. And you program this thing in. And then if you show that behavior, you start checking, say, the internet, surfing Facebook at work, it'll give you a warning. And then if you don't do it, you keep on checking your Facebook or whatever, then it will send out an electric shock. So it's almost like the Milgram experiments where, you know, you used to kind of the experimenter would shock you. Now you're doing that to yourself. You're kind of electrocuting yourself.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about tracking in the workplace. Karen, let's talk about another phenomenon borne out by big data in the workplace, just-in-time scheduling. What is that?
Yeah, so, you know, when you're scheduling, this is something that's pretty widespread in retail and food service, those types of industries. And it used to be that when companies would schedule workers, they would kind of bear the risk of overstaffing or of slow sales, right? And that was just a cost of doing business. So you put three employees on in the morning, and you know that was more or less, you know, about what you had for that shift. Now, a lot of these companies are using algorithms and new types of software to schedule labor using lots of predictive factors and real-time information about sales, about things like weather, special events, that kind of thing. And that sounds great, right? It sounds like it's just a way to sort of optimize labor and make your processes more efficient. The problem is that those algorithms can really wreak havoc on workers' lives by setting just really unpredictable and unlivable schedules. So, for instance, giving workers like less than a day's notice before they have to come into work, giving them really big fluctuations in the number of hours per week that they work, things like that. Actually, there have been some lawsuits about some McDonald's workers who were ordered to come to work but not to clock in until the algorithm said, you know, the sales were high enough for them to do that. So, you know, all of those practices make it really difficult for workers to get childcare, to hold down other jobs, to go to school, that sort of thing.
Let me get a quick call. I'm from Jack in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Jack. Can you quickly tell us what's on your mind?
Yes. I have a boss that I work in a retail establishment. This boss, when we started work, asked that we add her as a friend on Facebook. That was fine and well until she started making inappropriate comments to friends about doing business with her. And it got to the point where it got to be really intrusive. So I unfriended her. Then she sent a memo out to everyone saying she wanted to make all of us administrators on her retail Facebook page and needed our passwords. And we were to give them to her, and we did give them to her.
Wow.
I got a phone call from a friend late one night and said, hey, listen, your boss just sent me a private message. She's going through your friends list and sending messages saying, you know, you need to come. We're having a sale
all right,
this week.
Jack,
you need to come shop at our store.
Jack, I gotta. We're going to take a. I have to take a break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about using technology and data to measure employees in the workplace with my guest, Esther Kaplan, editor at the Investigative Fund. Karen Levy is a fellow at the Data and Society Research Institute. Andre Spicer, professor of organizational behavior at the Cass Business School in London. Our number 844-724-8255. And Karen, you know, I know that I'm listening, I'm hearing that everybody wants to keep track of everything 24/7. But how do we expect technology to know when we're brainstorming or we're staring out of the window just thinking? Or as you write, it's the uncountable that counts. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, there's this ethos that the way that we know things now is to measure them, right, is to track them and count them. And then we can optimize once we know, you know, how many of something we have. But you're right. A lot of work is really not quantifiable, or, you know, if we choose not to count it, then what happens is that the burden of that work ends up being borne, you know, often by workers, by the people who are the least able to bear it. And I think kind of one of the issues that underlies this is that, you know, there's a tendency to want to consider labor as just like another input into the machine. But people are different, right? Labor is different. And there are a lot of externalities, you know, from public safety, if you have a tired trucker on the road, to, you know, not being able to get childcare for your children if you're, you know, you work at a Starbucks that uses just-in-time scheduling. You know, all of that stuff doesn't get factored in so much to algorithmic decision-making.
Mm-hmm. Andre, you've actually compared the system of management and self-criticism at Amazon headquarters to the Cultural Revolution in China. Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, so the fascinating thing with the Amazon system is it involves both what we call peer criticism. So your peers can log on and talk about your failings on a kind of a web platform, but also a huge amount of self-criticism. Now, if you go and look at what happened during the Cultural Revolution in China, a major part of that was basically the same kind of thing, peer criticism and self-criticism. So we had to talk about how you weren't living up to the kind of communist ideals. The other thing which is fascinating is that Amazon have adopted what's commonly called a rank and yank system. So you basically rank people into a group of A players who get a big bonus, B players who basically get to keep their job, and C players who get third prize, which is basically you're fired. Now, the interesting thing is this system has been tried many times before. GE started it in the 80s. And in many cases, it's actually failed. There's very little scientific evidence to show that it actually works very well. So it seems to be more about ideology, what people believe is right, rather than what actually pays off. What it does actually produce is sabotage. Workers tend to sabotage each other. And if you look at the New York Times piece on Amazon, it bears this out. It talks about how they would throw colleagues in the deep end of the pool to get their bonuses and so on.
Esther, does this pay off at all?
Well, I think that one of the things that's striking to me is that a lot of these technologies have exploded precisely in the years since the financial crisis of 2008, when we've had one of the most slack labor markets on record in this country since the Great Depression, right? So these systems were created at a time when you could fire at will, you could make jobs intolerable to your employees and count on there being a long line of people at the door to replace them with. So that idea of retention being a value was just not present during the period that these systems have been so rapidly adopted. I think the question is, now that the labor market's tightening a little bit, is there going to begin to be a shift where retention actually becomes a bigger priority? And this is up and down the food chain. The just-in-time scheduling systems that Karen Levy was just talking about in retail and fast food, Starbucks, et cetera, that's based on the idea that there's an infinite supply of minimum wage workers out there. So you can make a job intolerable, you can make the hours inconsistent, you can make it impossible to have a second job or a or night school or a kid to take care of or an elderly parent, because there's going to be another one knocking on the door for the job the next day. And then we saw that in the New York Times Amazon piece as well, that their whole style is churn. To me, that's a set of priorities that reflect the fact that employees' interests, concerns, well-being was just never factored in. Now, these algorithms are very sophisticated. Employee interests could be factored in. These systems could be modified to take into account the needs of workers. That just hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this a little bit before, Karen, about the fall of unions and influence. If unions were stronger these days, would we have such abuse, do you think?
I mean, some of the recent lawsuits and recent kind of motions to try and reform just-in-time scheduling practices, things like that, have come from workers that are striving to unionize, particularly in fast food. So I think there's certainly some recognition that more labor power would help, right? Mm. They all boil down to just being straight economic issues, right, about livability and being able to get a fair wage. But I think there are some technical solutions, too, that can help to kind of reintroduce, as Esther was just saying, these algorithms and the companies that make them are very sophisticated. And some of them recently, actually, especially after some of the popular backlash in the press, have taken some steps to try and give managers better options to create more humane schedules, or give employees tools to like swap schedules between one another, mm-hmm. things like that. So I think there are probably some top-down regulatory solutions and some labor solutions, and maybe some things that the tech companies can do to try and help.
All right, this is a terrific storyline. We're going to continue this and continue following the story of technology, you know, and it does go way back to when we all talked about people losing their jobs because of robots and stuff like that. So Esther Kaplan is an editor at the Investigative Fund, a nonprofit reporting workshop in New York. Karen Levy is a fellow at the Data and Society Research Institute. And Andre Spicer is a professor of organizational behavior at the Cass Business School at City University of London in the UK. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Did you ever watch the TV show 30 Rock? Well, in one episode aptly named Sun Tea, the character Liz Lemon is grossed out by her coworker Frank Rositano, who she catches, well, keeping jars of a certain liquid in his office. But another character, Kenneth, steps in to show Liz what's become of those jars' contents.
Mr. Rositano has actually been emptying his jars out there.
He's been pouring them out the window? Oh, that is beautiful.
Yeah, what she sees below is a flower box bursting with flowers, fertilized in this case by Frank's pee. I always thought peeing on pansies would actually kill them. Don't we shoo dogs away from flower beds? But scientists have been investigating whether urine can be a viable fertilizer. And joining me now to discuss whether urine could be the new gold standard for fertilizers, sorry about that, is Krista Wingington. She's assistant professor of environmental engineering at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She joins us from Michigan Radio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I always thought urine was bad for plants, to keep the dogs away, the brown spots on the lawn.
Well, I think if it's used correctly, it can be very good for plants. We just have to get the dose right.
Give us an idea of why urine should be helpful to growing plants.
Well, urine contains a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium. In fact, if you look at what we excrete, more than half of the nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium that we excrete comes out in our urine, and that tends to be what we add to plants to fertilize them. So we're interested in capturing those nutrients and turning it into a fertilizer product rather than sending it to the wastewater treatment plant where it's treated in different ways.
And how can we capture it? What's the best way to do that?
Well, there's toilets that are made specifically for source separation or urine diversion. That's what we call it. And this is becoming common in other parts of the world. It's still a fairly new idea in the United States. But there's definitely ways to capture the urine where the users of the toilet really aren't inconvenienced at all. It's just like they're using a regular toilet.
Can it be as simple as just pouring it out onto the plants like on the TV show?
Well, we're definitely not we're not suggesting that. What we're interested in doing is collecting the urine and then turning it into a more controlled fertilizer. There's things in fertilizer that we probably don't want to be applying directly to plants and to the soil. Urine can contain pathogens and it can contain pharmaceuticals. So we're looking at how to remove those and turn it into a safe and practical fertilizer.
You've been working with the Rich Earth Institute in Vermont. They have been collecting urine on a community-wide scale, correct?
That's right. Yeah, I think they're the first organization in the United States who's doing that at the community scale. And so we were funded by the EPA and the Water Environment Research Foundation. It's a large collaboration with the Rich Earth Institute, with the University of Buffalo, Hampton Roads Sanitation District in Virginia, and Brown and Caldwell Engineering. So it's a large project, and we're looking all the way from the practical aspects of collecting urine through treating it, turning it into a product, and then the Rich Earth Institute in Vermont has these farms where we actually apply the products and see how it does. We're growing carrots and lettuce. So that's, yeah, it's a large project and it's ongoing.
What do you have to do to treat it?
We're looking at different things. So there's two things you want to that you want to focus on. First is condensing it. So it's not very practical to truck large volumes of urine around. So it's better to concentrate the nutrients down to smaller volumes or even as precipitates. So concentrating it, that makes it cheaper and easier to move around. And then the other thing is we need to get rid of the pharmaceuticals and organisms that are in it. So we can pasteurize it by heating it up. That gets rid of the microorganisms. Precipitating out this mineral called struvite, that tends to get rid of the pharmaceuticals. But there's researchers who are doing things like ion exchange to pull off the nitrogen and phosphorus ions, using reverse osmosis to concentrate the nutrients. There's lots of different ways you can treat it, but it's all about concentrating and getting rid of some of the other constituents. Yeah.
If I wanted to try this at home, what should I do?
Oh, well, people are doing it at the household scale. So part of this research is trying to help the EPA come up with guidelines, maybe policies on what should be done with urine before it is applied to plants and to soils. So I don't think I'm in a position to tell people what to do at the household level, but it's being done, and there are lots of websites out there where people can get help on what they should do before they apply it to their yards.
I'm sure. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday for PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Krista Wigington. I think we may have somebody on the phone or a caller to tell us what they're doing. Hi, Ivan in Cincinnati. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks, Ivan, for taking my call. So just get really quick to it. I'm originally from California. I used to stay at my friend's house a lot, Pasadena, so shout out to KPCC. And because of the whole drought, he was really worried about, all the waste when flushing just the regular house toilet from just urinating. So he started urinating outside, and he has a bunch of orange trees there. And one day, we got really brave, and we tried one, and they're huge, and they're just beautiful. And I swear to God, it was the best orange I've ever had.
There you go. Certainly for California, saving water. All right. Thanks for sharing. Do you have a comment, Kirsten?
Yeah, I do. So I think that's one advantage to this urine separation is that right now the way we handle urine is we flush it down the toilet, and we do that with water that's been treated to a drinking water standard, and we flush a lot of water. So we flush several times a day, gallons of water every time. Most of those are for flushing urine down, and so especially in places like California where all of that water is so precious, it really doesn't make sense to be flushing so much down the drain.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a waste of water in California at this moment. So do you think this will catch on, this whole idea? What's it going to take to scale it up?
Yeah, I think so. I definitely expect in the next 10 to 20 years people are going to hear more about this. The number one thing that's holding it up right now is infrastructure. I mean, we have a great sanitation system in the United States. But there's definitely some inefficiencies. The water is one of them. But to actually make this work at the society level in the United States, we'd have to rip up, all of the sewer lines, install a separate line for urine all the way to the wastewater treatment plant. And if we wanted to do this in Detroit has 3,500 miles of sewage lines. So you can just imagine the scale that project would be, ripping up all of the ground and putting these, you know, urine-only pipes in. So I think infrastructure is what's holding us back. But definitely at maybe the building scale or at the household scale, I think we'll see more of this in the future. And we're already seeing some buildings. Our partners at HRSD in Virginia, they've taken their headquarters and put in source separating toilets, and they're collecting it in a tank outside for the research.
Is there any bacteria that could be harmful to plants or groundwater?
Yeah, there's bacteria that would be harmful if it came back into contact with humans. So I think some people think of urine as being sterile, but when you collect big batches of urine, people have urinary tract infections, and that can be bacterial or viral. And also, whenever you collect urine, you do tend to get some fecal contamination. So there's pathogens there, and that's why it needs to be sanitized.
Well, since give us something to think about this weekend.
That's right.
Yeah, and as you say, there are websites out there if you want to learn how to, you know, be a whiz in your garden, you know, so to speak. Well, the people out there to help you. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, Krista.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Krista Wigington is Assistant Professor of Environmental Engineering at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. One last thing. Back in the 1980s, I was taping a segment of a TV show I used to do called Newton's Apple, and the director unexpectedly stopped the taping and couldn't understand why. It was going so very well. Then Jimmy Carter walked out onto the set. He extended his hand and said, "I was in town, just wanted to say hello." We shook hands, chatted for a few seconds, and then he left as quietly as he came. Our paths had crossed briefly in my work covering Three Mile Island and during his prescient calls in the White House for renewable energy. I have not met President Carter again, but as I watched his news conference yesterday announcing the spread of his cancer, I was reminded of his warmth, his intelligence, and eternal optimism. He was one of the most general and smartest politicians I've ever met without actually training in nuclear engineering. He actually had a training in nuclear engineering, and I wish, of course, him all the best in coming months. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer, at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And to all our Sci-Fi Book Club members out there, we're going to talk like a computer. We want you to talk like one. Our latest education activity is going to teach you how to write your name in binary. I like that. Try it yourself at sciencefriday.com/binary. And you'll learn how to do that. And if you'd like to write us, please, not in binary, send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 00036. In New York, I'm Ira Flatow.